is one of the paragraph I'm going to have to read.
Okay.
In the winter term, I met two bright, interesting girls in my economics class, Dorothy Jones and Rose Marcus. I'll skip about Dorothy, but Rose was the daughter of a New York garment manufacturer and had a strong interest in labor problems. She was my companion on numerous weekend trips to see Chicago, such as to the Wilson Company's meatpacking plant. She and I passed out handbills in front of the Weil Company's plant, urging the underpaid and overworked factory girls to join a union. Although against police regulations, we weren't arrested. We went to movies and read Morris Cohen together. Morris Cohen was a philosopher of... Oh dear, what was he? Gosh, I can't even remember. I think he wrote a book on the philosophy of science, but I'm not sure. Although I like Rose, our friendship remained just a friendship. Once, after walking with her along the beach at Jackson Park, I quoted to her, quote, "A primrose by the river's brim, a primrose merely was to him." Her name was Rose. Well, here's some more that's relevant. In the winter of 1931, the economic depression sank to its worst low. Faculty and students in the social sciences were properly concerned and explored alternatives to capitalism. I read both Karl Marx's Das Kapital and Lenin's The State and Revolution, but found them heavy going and uninspiring. Of Marx, I wrote my parents, how Marx does give vent to his hatreds. Combination of ponderous German wit, peevishness, and vilification makes interesting reading. Of Lenin, my comments were, his picture of the perfect communist society where the state is abolished and order is maintained by the social pressure of the armed workers, where sentimental intellectualism is anathema, and when deviations from type are ruthlessly coerced into line, is a bit depressing. Nevertheless, I joined the University Socialist Club and attended meetings of the League for Industrial Democracy. At the Socialist Club, I hoped to find a cause I could support, but I wrote to my parents instead. I'd be pleased if I could work up a bit of enthusiasm for socialism, but alas, the fuel is damp on which fall the sparks of socioeconomic reform propaganda. For the Socialist Club, I passed out handbills to people watching a flyover of 600 War Department planes. The handout read, "We have a War Department, why not a Peace Department?" Finally, in May, I resigned from the club, writing my parents, "I take no delight in meddling with the status quo." Oh, there's lots of this.
did any of those activities create a problem for you in World War II when you were involved with the Manhattan Project?
Yes, as a matter of fact, you're a very knowledgeable person. I don't remember whether I got around to writing that up or not, but I'll try to remember what.
Well,
it was.
Can come back. We can cover that when we get to it. But to that point, then. Because that's one thought as you were describing all of this. I was wondering how that...
Yes, it surely did. Hadn't I better tell you about that now before I forget?
All right.
These timid ventures into socialism in 1930 came back to haunt me in 1941. When I was engaged in developing the process for extracting uranium-235 from natural uranium for the Manhattan Project. And when I was required to submit a history of my previous life experiences before I could be granted security clearance to continue research, I, of course, gave them an account of where I had been and the courses I had studied and things of that kind, but quite properly neglected to mention that I had attended meetings of the Socialist Club at the University of Chicago and related matters, and was very much afraid that the investigation of the FBI would turn up the fact that I had dabbled in socialism a number of years earlier and had even considered going to the Soviet Union to see how communism worked at first hand. I was so go. I'm sorry, I can't remember all the details of it, and turn off your tape recorder while I try to reflect on this for a minute.
I'll just leave it running, then
all right.
We'll just cut all that out.
Many years later, when I was assigned by the M.W. Kellogg Company, for whom I was then employed, to work on the design of a gaseous diffusion plant for separating uranium-235, and was obliged to obtain a security clearance in order to continue work. I was very much afraid that the FBI, who conducted these investigations in those days, would find out that I had attended meetings of the Socialist Club at the University of Chicago and had at that time even considered and made an initial contact with the Soviet chargé d'affaires in the consulate in the city of Chicago to obtain a visa to visit the Soviet Union and see how socialism operated at first hand. If the FBI ever found this out, it apparently either didn't appear in their permanent record of my past life, or wasn't regarded as a disqualification to grant me security or clearance many years later. But at the time that I applied for, these things all came to the fore in 1951, at the time that I had just been offered and accepted a position to teach nuclear engineering at MIT, and at the same time was offered an opportunity to start a Office of Operations Analysis for the then new U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. I had to submit an account of my previous life history in order to be granted a security clearance by the then new Atomic Energy Commission, and I was very much afraid that these dabblings in socialism that I had undertaken 10 years earlier would be cited against me, and I'd been denied the clearance, denied the opportunity to work in the Office of Operations Analysis, and would not have access to the classified information I'd need in order to obtain a good personal background for teaching the subject in an unclassified manner at the MIT. Fortunately, for some reason, either the FBI didn't find out about my dabble in socialism, or they didn't regard it as a detriment because I was granted security clearance. I could have access to classified information from which I made unclassified excerpts, had them submitted for approval by the Atomic Energy Commission, and was able to work them first into notes for my class and later into the textbook that Tom Pickford and I published called Nuclear Chemical Engineering. Are you familiar with that book, by the way?
Only by title, I don't.
Let me show you. I have a copy.
All right.
Two editions. The first one was published in 1952, I think. No, 57. But it was, I was enabled to write it by having to develop a curriculum in nuclear engineering at Cornell, at MIT, and to teach a subject that I had developed myself called nuclear chemical engineering. After I'd been there for a year, I was joined by a man who had been an assistant professor in the chemical engineering department there, Tom Pickford, and he wrote this book. You're probably familiar with it.
Only by title. I've not seen the book itself.
That's the first edition, published in 57. And after we'd offered the course for a number of years, they brought out a second edition in 1981.
It's very recent.
Yes, it's still used. I still get some royalties from it.
There must have been considerable change between...
Oh, there was. Well, you see, what happened between the two was that there was a lot of declassification after 1957 that enabled us to provide a much more complete curriculum. And a lot of new developments, too.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in 1957, there weren't any nuclear power reactors operating in the United States at all. And by 1981, it was the second largest producer of electricity after coal in the United States.
It's fascinating. Could we come back to Chicago and
yes.
How you left Chicago and went? I'm assuming you went to MIT directly after you left Chicago.
No, let me get my bearings straight here. But there was a very interesting interlude in my life in between there at Chicago. I had met and enjoyed the company of a graduate student in economics, which was the field I was studying, named George Shaw Wheeler, who had recently married another graduate student in economics named Eleanor Wheeler. And I was really at loose ends at the University of Chicago because I found that I wasn't adept at the social sciences at all. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. So Wheelers were kind to me. They invited me to their small apartment for an occasional meal. We discussed the state of the world, which was economically pretty bad in those days. And I guess George made the suggestion that, well, since I didn't know what I wanted to do, wasn't particularly adept at the social sciences, why didn't I just take the summer off, do some non-mental work that might enable me to get my act together again. His parents ran a family fruit farm on the Columbia River in central Washington State, and they needed summer help, and George wrote his mother, Jeannie Wheeler, and asked whether she'd be willing to have me come out as an unpaid summer hand who they would provide room and board for, but I would simply help during the summer while I decided what I wanted to do next. And the Wheelers were very kind and did offer me this opportunity to come out, and I accepted and went out to Washington State to take this job. But I had just about used up all the money that I had saved from my brief employment in Buffalo for the National Ammonium and Chemical Company after spending a good deal of it to get my education at the University of Chicago, and I didn't want to call on my parents for more financial support. So I decided I'd hitchhike out from Chicago to Columbia River Valley in Washington. And that made a very interesting, that was a very interesting experience. I don't know whether that was in any of the chapters that I, you haven't seen these chapters, have you? I don't know whether any of these chapters or not. Here we are. You mind if I read you some of this? In the June of my year at the University of Chicago, when I was at loose ends as to what I wanted to do, there were two events that led to a summer that cured my uncertainty and the depression that I was feeling because I wasn't getting any worse in my plan for a life's career. I read Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage, and I had dinner with George and Eleanor Wheeler, fellow students whose family had a fruit farm in the Columbia River Valley in Washington. In Mom's hero Philip's release from a cruel infatuation by a summer of carefree farm work, I saw a way for me to take the advice of a psychiatrist that I'd been seeing to manipulate my environment by following another doctor I'd been seeing's advice that I spend the summer away from intellectual activity. When I mentioned my idea of summer of farm work to George and Eleanor Wheeler, he kindly arranged for me to help in his family's orchards by doing some of the summer work he would have done had he not been obliged to remain at the University of Chicago. So I decided to hitchhike to the farm on the Columbia River in Washington owned by George's grandmother, Mary Shaw. I know that this is a lot of detail, but it's such an interesting and helpful experience that I am going to read you some more.
Please do.
Because this is better than my 60 or later memory. I asked my parents, as I say, I decided to hitchhike to the farm on the Columbia River in Washington, owned by George's grandmother, Mary Shaw. Quite incidentally, Mary Shaw was the name of my subsequent wife's own grandmother. Of course, at that time, I didn't know anything about that. I asked my parents to send me a rubber poncho army blanket and knapsack I had used at camp 10 years ago. I packed it with work clothes, a sweater, a spare pair of shoes, soap, shaving gear, a toothbrush, and toothpaste. I ordered a copy of Kane's Theory of Probability to be sent to me in Washington for summer reading. Early June morning, July 7th, this was 1930, I shouldered my knapsack and took the Chicago Elevated to its western terminus in Western Springs. While waiting for a ride. In those days, hitchhikers were considered safe company for motorists, and east of the Rockies, I had no trouble getting rides. I spent the first night at Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where a kind farm family gave me a sumptuous handout for 10 cents and allowed me to spread my poncho and blanket in their haymow. I spent the second night, July 8th, on the ground in a park in Omaha, Nebraska, and the third night, July 9th, in a tourist camp in North Platte, Nevada, where I got some soon-to-be useful advice on how to hop a ride on a freight train. After North Platte, the country was wilder and rides were harder to come by. In desperation, I went to the railroad yards where a freight train was being made up and climbed aboard between two boxcars. Crazy thing to do. I traveled 110 miles that way until I was discovered and ordered off the next stop. I rode the last 60 miles to Cheyenne on July 10th with a mulatto and an asthmatic Model T, who I felt sure would have held me up had I not assured him that I'd ride with him again the next day after getting $10 I expected at the post office. On July 11th, I was able to get only one ride, and after only 51 miles to Laramie. There had been so many holdups that no one wanted to pick up strangers in that sparsely settled country. On July 12th, I waited all day on the outskirts of Laramie for a ride across Wyoming Badlands, but motorists wouldn't give strangers a ride across that wild country. By late afternoon, four of us were still waiting for a ride. One of the men, Shorty Armbruster, was an experienced hobo. He'd been a brakeman on a railroad until his wife died. He suggested that we join him and hop a ride on a westbound freight. I bought some oranges and went with Shorty and the others after dark to the railroad yards where a westbound freight train was being made up. With Shorty's advice on how to avoid railroad dicks, you know what a dick is? We climbed into the empty compartment at the end of a refrigerator car that would hold ice when in service, pulled down the hatch, and waited for the train to start. Fortunately, our compartment wasn't inspected, and after midnight, the car was coupled to the train, and we started off, hopefully bound west. When we were well on our way, we opened the hatch, saw the last quarter moon on our left, and knew we were headed in the right direction. Oh dear, I'm sorry, I just have to read you some more of this. After I shared my oranges, Shorty passed around some lighthouse religious tracts, one of which quoted from the Rubaiyat, "Earth could not answer, nor the seas that mourn in flowing purple for her Lord forlorn, nor rolling heaven with its signs revealed and hidden by the sleeve of night and morn." That suited my melancholy mood perfectly. The next division point, Green River, the train stopped for what seemed forever, and we were afraid we'd have to leave our ride, but it started again. In the morning, when we came down from the desolate Wasatch Mountains into the green, irrigated farmland around Ogden, Utah, we knew what Brigham Young meant when he said to his little band of Mormon followers, quote, "This is the land," unquote. I left the train in Ogden and went to a cafeteria for my first meal in 20 hours. The raspberry and cream and beef stew were the best food I'd ever tasted. More Excuse me while I read you some more.
Sorry.
On July 14th, I got a ride with a farmer in a Model T Ford truck to a farm where the irrigated land gave way to sagebrush and desert. This was in southern Washington state. Again, rides were scarce. Finally, I decided that I might as well walk to the next town and started down the hot road. Soon I came upon a car whose lady driver was having trouble changing a flat tire. Despite the mistrustful objections of her 12-year-old son, the lady, Mrs. Henry East from Houston, allowed me to change the tire and offered me a ride west with them. I convinced them that Baker, Oregon would be a good place for them to spend the night. I didn't tell them that I had a letter of introduction to a friend of my grandmother in Baker and that Baker would be a good place for me, too. In Baker, I had a cordial reception from Grandma's friends, the Hoskins, who kindly gave me a bed and bath for the night. Now listen to this. I told them about my travel adventures and had what was for me a new experience, the wide-eyed interest of their teenage daughter. In the morning on July 15th, I drove the east to Umatilla, Washington, took a car ferry there across the wide Columbia, and rode with them to Pasco, Washington, where our routes diverged. One more ride took me as far as Richland, Washington. Richland, on the west bank of the Columbia, was 30 miles south of Hanford and 3 miles south of White Bluffs, where the Wheelers lived. Rides were scarce across the unirrigated desert between Richland and Hanford, so I decided to spend the night in Richland to take the bus the next morning to Hanford.
That's the same Hanford where the plant...
That's the point I'm coming to.
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm going to read you some more,
please,
because it was all so unexpected and so interesting, and it's still so vivid in my memory. In 1931, long before the Manhattan Project, Richland, which was the headquarters for the that branch of the Atomic Energy Commission years later. Richland was a sleepy little town with a grocery, a hardware store, and a post office on the main street near the river, and just a few houses with irrigated fields on the side street running west. I walked down the side street to its end looking for an empty field to sleep in. A sunburned, frail old lady stopped me and asked what I wanted. When I told her that I was looking for a place to sleep, she asked me to wait until father, that was her husband, came in from irrigating, and she would see. Mr. Messer was equally old, frail, and sunburned, and kindly invited me to sleep on the alfalfa in their barn. We spent a pleasant evening talking. Their son had managed Halliday's department store in Laramie, where I had stopped on my trip west. In the morning, they invited me to have breakfast with them, gave me a carnation to wear, and told me to come back soon. I thanked them warmly and insisted on paying them for their hospitality. I wish that I could have rewarded the Messers as the gods did Pyramus and Thisbe. Are you familiar with Pyramus and Thisbe?
No, I'm afraid of not.
Well, this is a story in Greek mythology where one of the gods disguised himself as a human and went around looking for some honest and considerate humans. And he found Pyramus and Thisbe, who were an impoverished Greek peasant couple, who took him in and befriended him. So, as a reward, I can't remember what he did do for them. At any rate, he assured them of immortal life in the hereafter. June 16th, 1930, I spoiled my record of free transportation by paying $2.50 for the bus ride from Richland to Hanford. There, Mr. Wheeler, who was the father of George and Eleanor, my students' friends in Chicago, met me with his Model T truck and drove me the last 3 miles to the Shaw Fruit Farm.